Hey, this is Chuck Dixon, and you're listening to Signal of Doom.
Well, you know, for me, the action is the juice. I'm in.
Hello, and welcome to Signal of Doom, episode 112. I'm Dave, and I'm without the main man tonight, Stu. Sick, very poorly, very, very poor health at the moment, struggling. I'm thinking like Luke Skywalker post that battle at the start of Empire Strikes Back against that big woolly monster, whatever he was called, and then they get him back eventually, and he's in the, is it a Bacta tank? That's how I'm picturing Stu right now, the poor guy. He's been sick for 3 days, listeners. And that means no Stu live in the studio, but Stu's going to drop in with some pulsating cameos throughout the show, which I'll insert in. So there will be some Stu, but it's limited doses. So you're stuck with me, Dave, and it's basically a solo album with a guest track, isn't it? You know, let's face it. And I'm picturing Bob Dylan, early 60s, about 64, you know, probably a little bit stoned from the night before, and, you know, got a batch of songs to record, just wants to get in the studio and just get it done. That's pretty much the vibe right now. And, wow, and more on that later. But I've been listening to quite a bit of Bob Dylan this week, just the last couple of days. It cropped up. Shout out to Jimmy Terzis at... we know him from Jimmy's Jargon, and I mean, fantastic. Eric and Jimmy Rule the Galaxy, what a show, and formerly Bruce Wayne's World as well. Big friend of the show, and we're chatting with him about music, and we're talking about like our best concerts of all time that we've been to. And I've got, you know, and we're going to do a list on the show next time we have him on. We're going to have him on shortly, actually. So big shout out to those guys, Eric and Jimmy. And Jimmy Terzis is always a lot of fun. But just chatting to him, I've seen Bob Dylan 10 times. And I absolutely adore Bob Dylan. It was my first ever concert when I was 18. So each one is special and different. He's a very eccentric performer, but also very good. So there's a lot to enjoy in Bob Dylan concerts. And when you see them over, it's been a span of like a long time, even though it feels like it's gone fast. Always interesting, always an event. And some of them are mind-bogglingly great. Like I remember my first concert where he was playing, but one he did in a, I think it was like the State Theatre here in Sydney, small little theatre, very close to the action. It was almost like somewhere you'd see like a school play or something, and you felt so close. And it was probably the most gripping one for me out of a lot of good ones. Now, anyway, turning to some news, because we're gonna cut through some news. We've got Old Man Logan Berserker as the trade of the week at the end, which we are going to do, and I believe Stu's got a review as well, so we'll hear his thoughts. I want to say we're heartbroken to report the passing of a Star Wars legend, Peter Mayhew, aka Chewbacca. Chewbacca, however you're supposed to say it. Chewie, I call him always, and I mean, the heart and soul of the franchise in so many ways, especially for a lot of young people back then. I mean, who didn't love Chewie? And, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's great that it's continued on and they've got a new guy doing it, obviously a young guy. Peter Mayhew had significant health problems. I think he was lucky to last as long as he did. Yeah, like, and in all honesty, a guy who gave a lot to Star Wars. And, yeah, it was his career. But, I mean, I think he deserves a lot of credit. You know, who doesn't like him? I mean, everyone likes him and everyone loves Chewie. And that's, you know, that says something about the performance. So that's sad. And he was, you see the pictures of him in, you know, in the photos that they're showing. And he looks like a guy who'd kind of played his last innings in a lot of ways. So peace and love goes out to him, and I'm sad to hear that, actually. I was on Facebook yesterday, and I saw R.I.P. Roger Moore, and I had that weird, like, isn't he already dead feeling? You know that you feel almost guilty because you're like, I thought he was dead, and it turns out it was from like 2 or 3 years ago, and, yeah, he had passed away. But there are people like that you're just like, are they alive? And, you know, if you're not like a hardcore fan, you don't know, because like they've slowed down as they've gotten older, kind of thing, and sort of you see the replays and you're sort of like, oh, but I was like, Roger Moore, I'm pretty sure he passed away a while ago. And yeah, he did. Now, it was Free Comic Book Day tomorrow here in Australia. What date is it? It must be, is it May 6th? Is that Free Comic Book Day? This is going to be a bit of a different show. I'm going to try to do a little bit more kind of on-the-spot research. Oh, I'm totally off. Like, it's May 4 is tomorrow, so it must be May 4. I don't know where I'm getting 6 from. That's fucking Monday, Dave. Like, it's the 3rd today. Like, this is how little fucking knowledge I have of time. You know, it's shockingly bad. Anyway, so it's Free Comic Book Day tomorrow here in Australia. I will post this show up tomorrow, and I strongly encourage from all around the world people to visit their comic stores wherever they go, because, you know, they put up these comics. And I always say, yeah, get a free comic book, you know, sure, but, like, get something else off the shelf as well. Like, you know, it's worth doing. And look, I did know this, but a lot of people don't know, and certainly didn't know this for a lot of years, that the stores have to buy those comics, and I assume at a reduced rate, but they're still incurring cost for stuff they have to give away. Like, I'll go on record. In a lot of ways, the market seems set up for stores to fucking fail. I swear to God, like I love comics, and I used to think I'd want to run a comic book store. And my favourite memory, other than King's Comics, is Labyrinth Comics down in Hobart when I was like 13. It was a wondrous place. And that was guys who were, you know, barely out of college, who obviously had a bit of money and poured it into the store. And it's what got me hooked. Like, it's what got me hooked beyond just casual. And I certainly, in my, you know, head, I was like, well, if I have some cash at some point in my life, like, you know, if I'm working and stuff, you know, we sort of fantasize about doing it, but, like, there's no way in hell I'd do it now. Like, honestly, like, but God bless those who do. And King's put on a terrific event at King's here in Sydney put on a terrific event at Free Comic Book Day, as do Kinnikinnia, who I also go to. And that's just Sydney. Like, that, and, you know, we've got a smallish market, but a dedicated market, and they really do put a lot of effort in. And we've had Jim from King's Comics on the show before, and we're a big friend of the show. So shout out to Jim. Go down to King's Comics if you're in Sydney, and to Free Comic Book Day, which will be tomorrow, which is when the show posts. So maybe have the fucking Signal of Doom playing in your earbuds, kids, you know, with the fancy technology of today, you know, with your glow sticks. I do like, I treasure my 40s now that I can be kind of the grumpy old man, because I always was. So, you know, hit your glow sticks and your cosplay. Yeah, and enjoy it. Go down there and they put on a great event. They make a lot of fun. And, yeah, I imagine it's one of their biggest days of the year, like, you know, in terms of sales as well. And there is a sale on as well. I think it's 20% sale off most of their stock. And that's worth getting. It's worth grabbing. Get in there. Enjoy it. I picked up, actually, in a sale today, I'm actually pretty pumped about this, Predator, The Essential Comics, Volume 1. It's a nice, thick, not quite phone book size, but pretty thick, all colour, Predator comics that Dark Horse have done, and featuring, I'm like speculating about what's in it when I've actually got it in front of me, and this is when it really sometimes, you know, I'm just fucking, you know, I'm behind the game, but I'm trying to get ahead of the game. Now, I can tell you what stories are in it because I'm holding it. Concrete Jungle, Dark River, Cold War, and I'm excited about this one, an adaptation of Predator 2. I love Predator 2. No, it's not as good as Predator fucking 1, but barely any film is. I dig Predator 2 for what it is. I know, shout out to Ray. From Into the Night, I know you're a Predator 2 fan as well, man. Blood Brothers, obviously. Yeah, so I'm pretty much, what does it say about me? Like, I'm reading my Savage sort of Conan Omnibus, Volume 1. I'm probably about, I'm looking at it now, a third of the way through, and this is a big, big thing. And I've got to be honest, I'm spellbound. My favorite Conan is Chuck Dixon, Savage Sort of Conan. I don't just say that because Chuck's such a big friend of the show, but like I genuinely fucking love that Savage Sword. Gary Kasparitz on art, amongst others, and it's gold. But this Savage Sort of Conan is pretty damn good too. So I'm picturing having a whole shelf of the omnibuses of Conan, the, you know, 70s comic, original comic, whatever you call it, and also the Savage Sword, and just gradually building it through the next few years, as I'm sure Marvel just keep releasing it. And I think with the Conan fans out there, these re-releases are going to do pretty well. Like, this is a damn fucking fine omnibus. And I've been sitting here, we just had Easter, and I had a day where I was just sitting, a cup of tea, the feet were up, I've got the bad back, so, you know, feet were up, the deep heat was applied, and I was just, like, in heaven reading Conan. And Michelle's like, are you ever going to leave this room and stop reading Conan? And I'm like, yeah, like, what's out there? what can beat this? But anyway, so that Savage Sword, but now I've got this Predator, and it's staring me in the face, and I love Predator. I mean, I'm actually a fan of the Predator as well. He's actually my favourite character. Arnie's great in Predator 1 and Danny Glover's great in Predator 2. But I give it up for the fucking main man who's Predator. Like, I would love them to do... These comics probably would do what I want, which is more from... I want more from the Predator's perspective. Anyway, so I'll do next show when Stu's back. I'll do a sort of review of what I've read of Predator, because I can tell you this weekend I have a fairly quiet weekend lined up after some pretty hectic ones recently, and I will definitely get a chance to read it. It's kind of all I feel like reading, to be honest, other than Conan. Here at the house, excuse me if this isn't interesting, like, but it's a solo fucking show, so it gets a little bit more fucking personal, or what passes for personal in my life. Basically, we've redone the whole lounge room and put our bookshelves up, which are mostly filled with my comics, as much as Michelle will allow, on the opposite side of the room, so it's more of a feature, and I've had a lot of fun because it's great when you go back through. You start, like, realizing, wow, in the last couple of years, I've really got some excellent stuff that I'm really fond of that looks really cool, that's kind of been tucked away, kind of hidden away in my office, and now I can get displayed out there. So, and you also see trades, because I'm a trade guy, trades that you just have no interest in anymore. Not that they're bad even, you've just completely outgrown them as a reader. Like, and, you know, I'll happily give these away. They're not, like, you know, going to make anyone rich, but I'm going to do it. So I'm doing a bit of a culling, but more than that, I'm realizing how much of a wealth of material. Like, I've built up quite a fucking library, you know, in a lifetime of collecting comics. As I said, I think I put one of Jim's kids through school, frankly, and I'm fairly confident of that. So, wow, so that's the first two fucking news items. So Stu would be, can you imagine how much he'd be fucking whining, complaining? Like, he would have cut me off, like, about hours ago in this, you know, kind of experimental free thought sort of rambling style that I've got going on now. So moving away from Free Comic Book Day, Avengers Endgame. Now, don't forget, Stu gave it a flat 10. I gave it a 9.5, which is as high as a mark as I basically give almost any movie. Honestly, that's... And I stand by it. Like, I stand by it this week. I am prepared to concede that I am biased towards the franchise and the subject matter. And if I was completely neutral, like dispassionate, like just watching it as a movie, it might be closer to a 9 or an 8.5. But, you know, fuck that. I really fucking enjoyed that movie, and I stand by my 9.5. I'm not embarrassed by it at all. You know, I give movies like Heat, Carlito's Way, Scarface, Dog Day Afternoon. These are movies I'm giving 9.5s to. Casino, Goodfellas, you know, and others of that kind of ilk. You know, and frankly, yeah, here's a fucking question that I meant to throw at Stu. What would I give, like, Star Wars, like The New Hope, A New Hope, or Empire Strikes Back? I'd be giving them 9.5s or 10s, frankly. I love Return of the Jedi, but I think the Endor act is the weakest act, and that lowers it, even though I love it. Like, the first half of Return of the Jedi, I love as much as anything in Star Wars. So, I mean, that's how high I think Avengers Endgame is. In terms of box office, which is something we obviously are very interested on the show,
hey guys, it's Solo Stew coming at you from my place. Unfortunately, under the weather this week, as I'm sure Dave's already told you. So I'm only recording two little bits for this show. First bit is, for me, the most interesting story of the week, which is the Endgame box office. And it's interesting for a different reason. It's not interesting because their numbers are big or because it's now holding a bunch of records, but it's just how much it broke the previous records by that's astounding to me. So to break it down, the domestic weekend for Endgame, $357 million. Second place, Captain Marvel with $8.3 million. 357 is monstrously big. But it's the global weekend that really paints the picture here. $1.2 billion taken globally is insane. So to give you some kind of idea, if you look at just look at domestics so far, opening weekends, and we're looking at the top five biggest opening weekends. Jurassic World, $208 million. Just beaten by Last Jedi, $220 million to take fourth place. Force Awakens, $247 million. So we're slowly creeping towards 250. Last year, Infinity War, $257 million. Monstrous performance. And this year, Endgame, $357 million. So it didn't just do what the last few record holders had done and beat it by 10, 15 million. It beat it by 100 million. And you look at, it's the same thing looking at global weekends. Top five global weekends, in fact, almost the same list. Jurassic World, $524 million. Massive weekend. Force Awakens, $528, $4 million higher. Then we've got Fast and Furious 8, which did amazing numbers internationally, $541 million. So, creeping up another $13 million. We then had a big jump last year to Infinity War, $640 million. $100 million bigger than the previous record holder. Monstrous opening. But this year, Endgame, $1.2 billion doubles that. It literally doubles Infinity War. So not only does it take the top spot, but it just obliterates everything before it. Let's look at domestic opening record holders. So these are the top 10 movies that have opened to a record number. So you start back at number 10, the original Spider-Man movie, Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man, did $114 million. And from there, you see it creep up slowly in lots of, normally, $10 to $20 million. So Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest at $135, Spider-Man 3 at $151, climbing up there. Dark Knight creeps in at 158. Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows number 2, part 2, takes 169. So we're creeping up there. Each jump, maybe $10 million. The Avengers came in with a big jump, 207. So there's roughly $40 million there. And that was a big weekend, $40 million. Jurassic World is only $1 million higher. Force Awakens comes in again, $40-ish million dollars higher. Another massive jump, the biggest jump we've got here. We then have Infinity War, $257, another $10 million jump, normal kind of progression. And then Endgame, $100 million higher. 2.5 times the biggest jump we've seen since Spider-Man. In the last, 10, 15 years, this is not just a jump, it's the biggest jump. But what we're seeing now is amazing. It's that the numbers are actually staying consistent to what we've seen with previous other films. The drop from day 1 to 2 and 2 to 3 is consistent with what we've seen for all these other Marvel films. It's actually right on the average. So it feels like this isn't front-loaded. It's not just going to do a massive burst up front and then wither out, because you'd expect to see a faster drop. It's probably not going to have the legs of a Black Panther, is what we're seeing, but it's going to do amazing numbers, similar to something like, you'd think, in Infinity War, but this started so much bigger. The ceiling is impressively high. We're thinking, I mean, this is going to be in the top three movies of all time. There's nothing that comes close. To give you some idea, single daily gross for a movie, domestic. If you look at how much a movie makes in a single day, if you look at the list of the top five, top ten, they're obviously always going to be day one of a movie. Opening day is the biggest day of a movie, and it starts dropping off from there. Now, in the top five, we have never seen anything other than day ones until this week. I mean, this week, Last Jedi comes in number five now with $104 million in a single day. Infinity War takes fourth spot with $106 million. That's opening day of Infinity War, $106 million last year. Endgame takes spot three with its second day gross. In day two, it made $109 million. Force Awakens is the only other movie that's beaten it on $119 million and in spot two. And then Endgame day one with $157 million. A $40 million jump from Force Awakens. I mean, these numbers are just astounding. It's just blown everything out of the water, and not by a small margin. So, to give a rundown, the list of awards, the list of records that it now has, it has the largest Thursday previews, beating out Force Awakens. It's got the widest opening, beating out Despicable Me 3. It's got the largest Friday opening day and single day, beating out Force Awakens, as we just said. Largest Saturday, with 109, previously beating Infinity War. Largest Sunday, previously beating Infinity War. Domestic opening record, beating Avengers Infinity War. Number one movie share. Now, this is an impressive number. 90%. Or in other words, $9 out of every 10 spent at the cinemas over this weekend went to this movie alone. It took 90% of the total movie-going budget. The last movie that did anything close to this was 84.5%, and that was Age of Ultron. So, I mean, this is, you know, just blowing everything out of the water. Highest per theatre average for a wide opening as well, over $75,000. Those are the kind of numbers that you normally see associated with a small Oscar indie release going out to 4 to 10 cinemas total, and it's getting massive buzz for Oscar kind of nominations. You don't see this kind of thing for wide release films. The previous record was in the 50,000s, and this is 75. It's a monstrous jump. It's got the biggest April, spring, and PG-13 openings, all taken from Infinity War. It's got the biggest weekend overall, taken. So that including all films, if you wrap up every film showing, cinemas made more money this weekend than they ever have before. Previously, that record was taken by the December 18 to 20 weekend of 2015. So 4 years ago, when this is the biggest weekend cinemas have ever had. Fastest to 100, 150, 200, 250, 300, and $350 million. It did $350 million in 3 days domestically, which is double the speed of Force Awakens, the previous record holder. International opening weekend, it's now got the highest one, more than doubling Fate of the Furious. I mean, it's just opening weekend worldwide, the 4D opening record, it's got the 3D opening record, it's got the IMAX opening record, it's got everything. It's just outstanding how just insanely big these numbers are, and the margin in which they've taken over. There's nothing that competes with this movie, and now they're kind of having to compare it to Avatar. It is basically the kind of the whale that they're hunting now. if you look at Titanic and Avatar as the two big whales out there, this movie, on current projections, will sit slightly short of Avatar. But projecting numbers this size don't work. They didn't predict Avatar would make it that far. They didn't predict that Last Jedi or any of these movies would do as well as they did. So it's anyone's guess at this point as to how far this goes, but look, it's going to comfortably hit the top three. It's going to probably make the top two. I'm hoping that it hits the top one.
So these are the totals as of, I would say, what's today here? So this is probably Thursday's totals in the States and worldwide. Right now, worldwide, sitting on $1.6 billion and $452 million in the States, just over $1.2 billion foreign. So that's 1.6. There's talk it's going to run down potentially Avatar. I think Avatar is still a fair way out in front in terms of any other competition. I really... Let's go to all time. Like, let's try to find fucking out if I can. Like, it's like I'm on Box Office Mojo, and it's like, how do I get to all time? Oh, here we go. Well, it's quite easy, actually, but all right. They didn't make it as fucking, you know, easy as I would like it. Let's have a look at all-time box office records. And frankly, I am more interested in the worldwide take than I am even just the US, because I think you've got to judge it. Like, it's taken $1.2 billion worldwide. So why are we not looking at that? So let's go to worldwide numbers. Okay, so Avatar took $2.7 billion. Titanic is second with 2.1, and Star Wars Force Awakens 2.06. Infinity War 2.04. So let's assume the heat on this seems to be even hotter than Infinity War, and I think most people are predicting that we'll go past Force Awakens. I mean, I could see it gobbling up Titanic. I mean, it's on track, you know? Like, it's on track. Interesting stat here. Avatar, 2.7 billion worldwide, almost 2.8. Domestic take was 27.3%. Domestic take of Avengers Endgame, this is US, 27.2%. So both movies are very strong internationally, and that's going to be interesting to see really how close it can go. And that's 10 years ago, Avatar. Like, Jesus, that's flown by. And isn't there just no Avatar hype whatsoever? And I love James Cameron. I've many times, like a lot of my favorite movies. Aliens, that's actually a movie that I'd consider close to a 10. And similar with Judgment Day. See, these are the kind of movies, when you've got a movie coming out in 2019 that you're pitching up against Stone Cold classics like Aliens, which I consider, when I saw it, I actually said, this is actually the perfect fucking movie. I still think Aliens is one of the best movies ever made. James Cameron, I mean, and yet the hype, like, I'm not excited at all for Avatar 2. Will I see it? Yeah. Yeah, I will, because I believe in James Cameron, but I'm not excited. Like, Terminator Dark Fate, I am slightly excited. Like, even though I feel like a sucker for it. Part of that's the Deadpool 1 director and James Cameron being more involved. And, yeah, Linda Hamilton coming back's a plus, but it's not going to, like, you know, make my fucking day. But Michelle's a huge Terminator fan, so I will take her to the screening. And, I mean, I'm not expecting too much. I mean, I enjoyed Genesis for what it was, although I fell asleep in the cinema. And I, you know, the only one I didn't really, really like at all, I felt Rise of the Machines was pretty flat rehash of Judgment Day. And I particularly felt Terminator Salvation, the one with Sam Worthington, was pretty poor. That was my least favorite. Like, I prefer Genesis more than I prefer Rise of the Machines or Salvation. Dark Fate, like, let's see. But it's not going to crush box office records. It's not going to be any kind of conversation to be an all-timer. It's just going to be one of those movies that comes and goes, and maybe it's good, you know. We'll see. So anyway, that's the talk, and it was amazing how much that movie took opening weekend. Let's have a look at what the opening weekend. So the opening weekend domestic was $357 million for Endgame. So that's impressive. And doesn't it make you think? Wasn't there a big scandal about like Solo? Okay, this is a movie that I've spoken about at length with Jimmy Terzis. Did it take about $200 million opening weekend? And remember the outcry of what a disaster that was? And I was like, yeah, it lost money. But there have been far bigger financial disasters in terms of box office movies than Solo. Like, yes, it lost money. So, yes, it's not a success. But I even still think it's like a 7 out of 10. But don't you feel that, like, the divisiveness of Last Jedi contributed to the malaise that gritted Solo, plus being too close to the release date? I look at a $200 million opening weekend. It's not that bad. That's a pretty good opening weekend for most movies. Let's just, while I'm here, well, it's more than pretty good. Like, if you have a $200 million opening weekend, it's an excellent opening weekend. But of course, it's Star Wars, and they assumed it would do numbers like Rogue One did on the Star Wars brand name. Okay, so let's have a look. Oh, hold on. Slow the roll. Okay, so... Oh, no, I take back everything I just said. Okay. The domestic total of Solo was 230, and that's where I was getting confused. And it had a 392 worldwide, and it had an opening weekend of 84. Okay, so it didn't crack 100. So, okay, that is a substantial disappointment. Okay, I reverse what I said then. So, but I still think that's not as bad a movie as, you know, people sort of remember it. It's somewhat ordinary, but I watched it again, and it's got some bits I really like. Like, I'd like to go into more detail with the Jimmy Terzis on Solo, just maybe 5 minutes, 10 minutes, to kind of pick his brain a bit more on it, because I rewatched it after speaking to him, and I was like, I like bits of this movie quite a lot. Anyway, it is what it is. A lot of this is perception, that old saying, you know, perception versus reality, and that certainly factors into, and momentum and stuff, that all factors into box office hugely. When it, you know, the word of mouth or buzz and stuff like that, and that was all negative on Solo. Now, so what have we got here? Oh, yeah, so turning to our next news item, this is an interesting one, and kind of something I was discussing with Michelle's cousin, actually, James, and his girlfriend, maybe even fiance, I think. Okay, this is about Captain America at the end of Avengers Endgame, and fucking spoilers, kids. Like honestly, like I, you know, it's been out a week. I'm not gonna play this game where I apologize for spoiling fucking Endgame. Like, literally, you're listening to Signal of Doom. Like, I'm flying solo, so I'll do what I like. Like, Bob Dylan will record the fucking song he wants to record. Okay, that rant at imaginary listeners are over. So basically, this whole thing, and Stu explained it, and, like, it made sort of sense, or it did make sense what he was saying, that the other version of Captain America, after he went back and, you know, supposedly fixed things at the end of Endgame, then lived his life, Stu was saying, in sort of a quiet married style with Peggy Carter, and then walked to the bench at the end of Endgame. Okay, like, and logically, you can see, or, you know, even narratively, like, that it's possible. But I think, I forget who was saying it. Was it James? Was it Rebecca? Was it both of them? Well, it wasn't me. And that... They were thinking he was he in an alternate dimension, which is what I was thinking as well. I don't know if I voiced this, but I was thinking I was confused, is what I was. And anyway, the Russo brothers have seemingly confirmed that he was in an alternate dimension. So make of that what you want, kids. But they very much did the, but who knows? Maybe this will be for the future stories, and kind of dance around the topic. And like, and I did say that I think the ending. I've been saying this since the movie. It deliberately left stuff open to be explored, and good. Like, you know, yeah, that's a bit cheesy sometimes, and it was in this movie when they do shots of particularly of the groups where they're like, and this franchise is going to do this, and this franchise is going to do this. Like, it does feel a bit like an ad, and it is. And I know you're supposed to think it's a tear-jerking scene, but, like, I can't help but see the fucking... I think they should almost put the logo underneath them. Black Panther, you know. Like, Bucky and Falcon coming soon on Disney Plus. Like, it's not that, like, we laugh, but it's not that far away from it. Like, fuck, it really isn't like, wow, if you click here, it'll start playing right now. Like, I can't help but be cynical of that, like, and I refuse to not be, because it, because that's the point of it. Like, I know we're supposed to, like, oh, but I just love the art of it. Yeah, I do, but, like, it's also a business, and that's what they're doing, so let's not forget that. Let's not give them a total free fucking pass. Like, don't hand over all your soul to Disney, kids. Don't give it all to them. These, you know, don't, like, don't remember, the mouse is there counting money. He's like, oh, my God, I'm so rich, let me gobble the world. Anyway, so the Russo brothers said Captain America is an alternate dimension, apparently, and all these wacky fucking adventures could possibly happen. And to be honest, I prefer that to, like, just Cap, like, kicking back at home with the super soldier Serum-inium. Like, that's a bit of a fucking weak move, Cap, if you did that. Whereas if he's in an alternate dimension, hell yeah. And I was saying that Dimension Z storyline, he, in the comics, is actually a pretty cool storyline, and in that he ages, and not as old as that, but I believe, like, he's like ages like 20 years or something, and like Sharon, you know, spoilers, you know, stuff happens to her, and then he comes back and he's older, but he's aged slower, and then something else happens to him, I forget what. Almost like a magic thing, and he totally loses the serum, I think, or at least he massively ages, and he's like old man Cap, which he was for a year or so, and, you know, kind of like John McCain kind of style Cap, super old, and they got some played out. So I liked, actually, that they were sort of touching on those storylines in a kind of classy way. And I certainly think a lot of it will be the execution of how they pull off these, like, side missions and fucking, like, hidden stories. Like, it could really suck, or they could or they do what they often do. They never do it. They just talk about doing it and then just never do it. And, like, you're just like, oh, why did I get excited for this corporate product that never really fucking gave me, you know, never really paid out, you know, like, properly. It's like you're at Vegas and you want to cash out, but you never quite cash out. Okay, and then finally you fucking, you know, oh, I broke even. Well, not really, yeah. You didn't really break even. That's just expectation versus what they get. And the most guilty of that for me was Fox with the X-Men. They had a lot of plans for X-Men that were curtailed by the response to Wolverine Origins. And I remember being so excited. They're going to do a Magneto movie, and they're going to do this, and they're going to do that. And I love Wolverine Origins. I think I saw it 7 times in cinemas, but it's a, you know, it's got some huge flaws, and it's got a terrible final act. But, yeah, like the way that they just kind of had a big opening weekend and then just died off, it kind of killed off a lot of the potential around those spin-offs. And I think Marvel's is definitely, you know, better. A lot better. They're probably the leader in the game, I would say, in terms of franchise spin-offs and all that kind of stuff. So it's going to be interesting, and watch this space. And, well, you know, I'm interested in seeing storylines that they're pointing to. Like, I'm interested. Like, I am fucking interested in a Bucky Falcon show. And I'm not, like, that hot on Falcon, to be honest. And I'm like, I don't mind Bucky. I like Bucky and Winter Soldier and stuff, like in the comics and everything. But I'm not, like, the biggest Bucky fan. Like, to me, he's still a bit of a punk. And Falcon's cool, like, but, like, I'm not the biggest Falcon fan, but I reckon there's a really good storyline to be had. And Rick Remender did a really good run with Falcon as Cap. I really enjoyed it. I think I read every issue, and it was really pretty entertaining stuff. He's a cool character. Now, here's a news item that is puzzling. The Vision and Scarlet Witch TV series will take place in the 1950s. Well, firstly, apologies to listeners, because for show upon show, I've been saying there's going to be a Loki and Scarlet Witch show. Now, even as I was saying that, I was like, what a weird pairing. But then I was like, well, I guess it's just magic, isn't it? Like, and that was what would go through my head every time I said it. Well, now it turns out the Vision and Scarlet Witch, which makes a lot more sense. So, you know, no one's corrected me, and might I say, including Stu. That's the thing. I've been saying that for probably 2 or 3 shows, and what I haven't heard is the correction police. And, you know, Adam the computer, where were you? I had to pick up my own error. Anyway, so Vision of Scarlet, which is set to take place in the 50s, which makes no sense at all. And
I can't stand Vision. I thought we'd finally gotten rid of him. So I'm actually annoyed that it's not Loki and Scarlet Witch because I thought we'd gotten rid of Vision. Don't mind Paul Bettany. Glad he had a bit of a career resurgence with Vision, but I personally have never liked Vision. I think he's the lamest Avenger. Like, well, there's lamer, but he's definitely like one of the leaders in the lame club. He's one of the reasons in the 90s and stuff, when I was in the 80s, when I was getting into fucking comics, I steered well away from it. If I saw Vision on a fucking comic cover, I was like, no thank you. Where's Frank Castle? Where's Ghost Rider? Where's anyone with some semblance of cool? Because this ain't cutting it at all. And like, now, like, you know, because, like, you know, Disney have so successfully fucking milked this, you know, Avengers franchise, like, people, like, love Vision. And I'm just like, I still don't buy it. Like, I still think he's just, oh my, he's so bland. Like, he's just a robot, like, and with the soul of a human. It's like, who gives a shit? Like, can I be the first one to say that's not that exciting? Like, that isn't really that fucking extraordinary. Like, I've got the soul of a human. So what? You know, like, it doesn't mean anything. Like, he's a robot with the soul of a human. And he, like, okay, wow. If only he was, like, a full, like, death war robot, it could actually be interesting. Like, that would be good. This reminds me of that comic I bought recently, Deathlok. Where's Deathlok? Deathlok is so much better than Vision. He's also a robot, kind of. He's a cyborg sort of thing. But whatever the fuck he is, he's a lot more exciting than Vision. And I would, if they said there's a Deathlok movie, like with Wolverine or something, I'd be in there. Like, I'd probably bring back energy drinks for that movie because I'd be so excited. I'm pitching that one for free, Disney. That's for free. Wolverine and Deathlok. And set in the post-apocalyptic world. That's what I really like about Deathlok. Like, you start reading, you're like, wow, it's really dark. Like, is it night? And then it's like in a sort of slightly dystopian, well, not slightly, it is a very dystopian, but slightly in the future. Like, and it's not very clear. And you're just like, I love it. So, yeah, I mean, basically I'm saying Deathlok's a lot better than Vision. And yet no one's talking about Deathlok. And it's only because Vision had the luck to be on a fucking team that became a huge marketing fucking name for Marvel Studios. If it wasn't for that, no one would be saying, where's Vision? Unlike, say, a Frank Castle Punisher, he does it all by himself. You know, like, he doesn't need to be on this fucking team. He doesn't need a team. He is the Punisher. Whereas Vision, it's like, hey, I'm Vision. I'm fucking member 62 of the Avengers. Remember me? I have a romance with Scarlet Witch, and it just endlessly plays on forever. Like, you don't care. Like, and you read old comics, and, like, it's just, honestly, it's like the love story of those two. I want to put a gun to my head and pull the trigger. That's how I feel when I read their love story. It's so banal. And, I mean, I could go on and on about how much I can't stand Vision. But anyway, I may not even watch the fuck. I don't even want to watch the show. It's set in the 50s. I hope he dies in an atom bomb. Like, it's the only good thing. That's the only reason. In an atomic test, I hope they blow up Vision. Who I thought was dead as well. Scarlet Witch, I don't mind, actually. Scarlet Witch, yeah, decent character, actually. Now, Phil Lord and Chris Miller, Lord and Miller, we know them as, are developing a Marvel TV universe with a 9-figure Sony overall deal. That means 100-plus million US kids. Yeah, I'm jealous. And this will be based on the Spider-Verse they established with Into the Spider-Verse. It also, I was reading up on this earlier today, because I was like, wow, does Sony own the rights to more than the Spider-Verse characters? No, but obviously they set up a lot of through lines into the Spider-Verse, and all those characters, I guess, Sony must own. They can do their own stuff with. And I checked, and there's also other projects, non-Marvel related, that they have a thing called Last Human, Mitchells versus the Machines, yada, yada, yada. So they've got other projects as well that are, I guess, incorporated to this TV deal. Pretty fucking cool. I saw a thing where people were, according to some of the trades, because they had a deal at Fox, saying they didn't want to be at Fox now that it's owned by Disney, owing to their dismissal from the Disney Star Wars movie Solo. I don't buy that. Well, I mean, I don't really buy that. I think in this business, like, you go where the money is, and they've just had a huge hit with Into the Spider-Verse and kind of rehabilitated their image a little bit after the solo, you know, schmozzle, basically, like, which I don't think anyone won out of that. And, yeah, and, like, God bless them. I mean, Into the Spider-Verse was fucking amazing. Like, you're watching and you're going, this is finally, they're finally doing stuff. And putting it in cinemas was the key. Because I've seen some incredible cartoons that Marvel have done over the years. Like, over the years. For example, Wolverine and the X-Men, a one-season thing. I fucking loved it. But it doesn't go beyond the real hardcore fanboys and the kids. You know, like, you know, and often the budget's not there. Whereas Into the Spider-Verse really burst at mainstream and made me, I mean, it's what I've known they could do all along. But, like, finally they've got that mass momentum behind them where they feel that's going to actually, you know, work on a box office level and put enough kind of bums on seats. So that was exciting, and I am excited by what they'll do with the Spider-Verse, because I was thinking about this before, like, the Spider-Verse characters, there's a lot of them. Like, Spider-Man is often just in his own world. Like, you could create compelling TV. Yeah, I'm a bit sad that, like, a Hulk can't drop in, you know, frankly. But I do trust them with the property, and I'll eagerly, like, I'll put this on record. I'm as eager to watch some of the stuff they do for TV animated based on Spider-Man and Spider characters as I am for, like, more than most things that come out from, like, pop culture, like, frankly. Like, you know, my cold, dead, jaded heart, like, has a flicker of emotion with these things. Like, because when I was watching Endgame, I was like, wow, I'm feeling something. I was like, boom, 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 boom. And you're like, man, I'm actually, it's a feeling. And that was cool, you know, like, you know, feelings are in scarce supply. Now, something I'm the most proud of probably of anything I've ever done on The Signal. This is probably, I'm going to put this on record. Episode 112, I call myself Lois Lane. Shout out to Michael Kellisham. You know it, Michael. I am a fearless reporter. I go where the story is. I always say reporters don't ask enough questions these days. It's like you read their fucking articles and you're like, this is boring. Like, it used to be more exciting, you know, like fucking Clark Kent and all those people and Lois, like, you know, especially Lois. Like, she'd fire off questions like fucking constantly. She was always in everyone's ass. And, like, that's the kind of style I like. So, anyway, we did Avengers Forever last week, okay? And if you recall, I mean, yeah, we enjoyed it. Like, it was good. Like, Kurt Busiek, Carlos Pacheco on our very professional job. Like, but I was saying, like, Roger Stern was a writer on this. Like, he's credited on the back cover of one of the trades, but he wasn't credited in the Comixology, you know, like, I don't know, liner notes or whatever you want to call them. It was really, and it was on his Wikipedia, and I saw articles written about it. And in all fairness to Kurt Busiek, I have a lot of time for this guy. You know, I'm not the biggest Twitter man, but, like, I often see his tweets. And generally, I'll read his tweets and be like, I agree. Like, or, you know, whatever. Like, it's like, yeah, the guy's got a great career. So I thought, Roger Stern's not on social media. I'd love to get Roger Stern on the show. I'd love to get Kurt Busiek too, because I have a lot of time for Kurt Busiek. Check out his Kona run, kids, and check out his Astro City and many other things he's done. But Roger Stern's hard to get to for some reason. I don't know why, because I consider Roger Stern one of the greatest writers of all time in comics. His Spider-Man might be my most favorite Spider-Man. But I'm like, okay, but Kurt Busiek is very available. I see a tweet from him every day it comes up. So I fired off a question, and I want to read this. And let this be an inspiration to others out there who, you know, want to get into the reporting business, you know. There's hope for you yet. Like, because, okay, so let's do the full exchange. Kicks off, David Finn, at Red Lantern 0051. At Kurt Busiek. Hi, Kurt. Big fan of your Conan run. It's great. On my podcast, we recently discussed Avengers Forever. It was fun. Awesome art. Can I ask, did you co-write this one with Roger Stern? I swear to sweet Jesus, literally less than 30 seconds passed. Kurt Busiek responded. Roger came in to help co-plot the book with issue 3 or 4. Boom! That got a like. Back to me. Thank you very much for your prompt response. Congrats again on your work. We plan to tackle Astro City soon. P.S. Love that Conan. I do love that Conan. And he responded back, thanks. Very glad you liked it and hope you enjoy AC, Astro City. Now, that's just a great exchange. And, like, you know, I don't bring up all the exchanges I have on you know, Twitter and Facebook and stuff, but what I like there is there was a story. And I was decrying Marvel for not putting Roger Stern on that trade. It really was pissing me off, actually. And it's nothing to do with Kurt Busiek. Kurt Busiek's a great writer and he's a legend and, like, you know, he's, you know, all praise to the guy. But the fact that he would come back so quickly and answer my question, like, thank you, Kurt. I really appreciated that. And, you know, I don't really get involved in, like, sort of, like, in the nitty-gritty kind of stuff because, like, frankly, it's boring. But like, I wanted answers, you know, and like, I didn't want to attack. That's my normal instinct, attack, attack, attack. But I was, no, rein it in. Like, this poor fucking guy, like, he wrote the book and potentially co-wrote it. Like, just ask the question. It's not his fault, like... And he responded. I was really, really, I was kind of proud of myself, actually. So that was interesting, I guess. Like, that was just Dave the Cub reporter. Like, I mean, I was just, it felt like I was Lois cracking a story. Afterwards, I was just like, I was so hot for a story after that. Like, I don't normally get excited by news, but I was like, man, is there government corruption? Like, is there something I can get my nose into? That lasted for a day or two, you know, before the news, like, rapidly became boring again. But, like, yeah, there was a moment where I was like, man, maybe I could jack it all in and just become a reporter. But then I was like, you know, it's a lot of work. I don't know. Be interesting, though. Now, moving on. Some huge news. And I'm proud to announce I share this news with our favourite collective, or one of our favourite, absolute legends, Inner Demons. Give it up for them, the Ghost Rider podcast. We are brothers, linked by fire. And live-action Ghost Rider and Hellstrom TV series is heading to Hulu in 2020. Yeah. I was so fucking excited to see this news. And so, basically, Gabriel Luna will reprise Ghost Rider from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Variety adds that... Yeah, he's returning to the role of Robbie Reyes, which he played at Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but the new series will be a completely new iteration of the character in no way connected to the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. storyline. In other words, they like the actor, they're just ditching the continuity so newcomers can jump in, and I believe I got that report from Dark Horizons. Now, look, this is great news. I liked Ghost Rider. I actually don't watch Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. since the first season, but I did check out several of those episodes just because I liked the writer so much. And he seemed very good and it was really cool. I know some people call him Ghost Driver, which is actually funny, because he drives a car. And I think I brought that up in the review we did of the Ghost Rider series. But I really, really, really dug those comics. Like I said to Stu at the time, that was one of the occasions where we read the trade and I didn't know what to expect. I mean, I like my, like, surprise, surprise, like, my favourite Ghost Rider is the original. Like, yeah, I'm old. But, like, I just like Johnny Blaze, like, because, like, I just, they're the Ghost Rider stories I read. That's who Nick Cage played. I love the original movie with Nick Cage. But Danny Keach has a lot of fans. I know Inner Demons, their favourite Ghost Rider is Danny Keach. And he's cool, but, like, I've got a lot of room in my heart for Robbie Reyes. I just like the writer. And I like that they're separating themselves from the continuity at Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which I think had gotten, you know, convoluted and stale, like, frankly, just the overall show, like, by the point they're at in their run, they're going to be so far down the track in their own fucking storylines, like, I just want the writer, minus any of that bullshit, you know? And I think Inner Demons said it best, like, because I was saying, what about Frank Castle coming in? You know, Jesus Christ, like, let's get Moon Knight in there. Like, let's get these fucking guys rolling, okay? Like, through the streets of LA, like a criminal wasteland, and the rider just going nuts. That's kind of where I'm coming from. I really feel this story in a big way. And let's not forget my pitch. Rider picks up Frank at the airport, turns around to him, the skull's on fire. And I think Stu said Uber. He's now an Uber driver. But that's not where I was coming from. Like, I viewed it as, like, just two gods in a car, basically. Like, Frank's like, let's get fucking out of here. Let's get punishing. Like, in a lot of ways, like, Ghost Rider and Punisher, like, they're quite aligned in the way they view the world, you know. And I like it a lot. And I'm sick that Stu's not here because, like, no offense to Stu, I'm not actually glad he's not here, but, like, he would be cutting me off on these points, but, like, you know, wow, you know, just be intense. There's a whole storyline in my head where, and I think in Inner Demons, they said, don't forget, Dave, the writer brings a lot of heat himself, not just like physical heat, but like the level of punishment and carnage he can bring. Think about that. And you start thinking about that and you're like, wow, this show could be awesome. Yeah, I'm really, really excited by the thought of a Ghost Rider show. I don't know so much about the other guy, Son of Satan or whatever. I mean, I know Colleen Doran on Facebook was a big fan, and Son of Satan, I mean, you know, I have seen him around. Like, I don't really follow it that closely. But, yeah, I mean, that's cool, but I'm mostly about the writer. I imagine that surely, I mean, you can see the linkage. Like, writer literally sold his soul, didn't he? I know Johnny Blaze literally got a book and summoned Satan. I always rate just the level of dedication. Like, he was, like, in the film with Nick Cage, which was my first exposure, he was tricked, kind of, a little bit tricked. I went and got the comic, the essential. Johnny Blaze literally gets a book out and summons Satan. So I was like, okay, he wasn't messing around. I still think Ghost Rider 1, the first Ghost Rider movie with Nick Cage, is underrated. I put it on and have a good time every time. I think it's a lot of fun. And, yeah, I don't know what else there is to say because, like, obviously this news is just broken. But they apparently tied in the Rider in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. to, like, the Rider lore, the Ghost Rider lore, which I think is also really cool. This could be a really cool series, and I just imagine this as I'm watching this show. I'm more excited by this than I am by, like, almost any TV coming out. Like, just the thought of this is getting me fucking pumped. And if I'm this pumped, imagine in Inner Demons, these guys must be chomping at the bit. Yeah, they must really be enjoying life. Now, turning away from this, because I could talk about that forever, but I don't have a lot more to say on it. It would just be me repeating what it said. Sonic the Hedgehog, a character I get compared to when I flick my hair up at work. Look, who doesn't love Sonic? But who doesn't hate the trailer? The trailer, it's woeful, but, like, the problem with the trailer is just the way Sonic looks. Like, how about making him look like Sonic? Like, have they thought of that? Like, instead of giving him some, like, weird human features, like teeth and stuff, why not just make Sonic how he is in the fucking games and, like, not even whatever he pops up in fucking constantly, like ads, make him look like that. So we just know it's Sonic without, like, this weird amalgamation. What's hilarious about this is, like, the online reaction was just, like, 100% negative. And then the director actually tweeted out, the message is loud and clear. You aren't happy with the design and you want changes. It's going to happen. Now, that is rare in this day and age. This guy's just folded his cards and gone, yeah, we fucked up. How does it pass testing? Like, I saw it and I was like, man, look, I'm by no means a Sonic fucking aficionado, but I know who the character is and he's kind of cool. But I saw it and I thought, that looks weird. I wonder how the internet will react to that. Well, the internet reacted how it always reacts, like, with outrage. But in this case, I think it was justified. I always love that there's some guy out there or girl who's just the biggest Sonic fan of all time. And God bless you, because why not? I mean, he was huge at a certain point, and a whole stack of people grew up when he was huge. So, of course, they're going to love him. So why not? Like, but then why change him? That's what I say. Like, why do we – like, it's an animated character. Why do you need to really change him from what he was, really? Why not just give the fucking people what they want? Which is Sonic looking like Sonic in a live-action movie. It shouldn't be that hard. Like, Garfield the movie. Garfield looked like Garfield. It worked at that level. Like, I went and saw it. It was funny for what it was. And you weren't going, man, Garfield doesn't look like Garfield. You looked at it like, that's an accurate rendering of what Garfield would look like. So take that as your fucking, you know, guide. Santa Clarita Diet, a show Michelle and I have watched. We're about 2.5 seasons the way through. It's getting cancelled after 3 seasons. I was going to ask you if he's watched this. I quite like it. Drew Barrymore. Who's the other guy? Is it? I want to say it's Timothy Oliphant, but I could be wrong there. Let's, you know, it's my solo show. Let's Google who the other actor is in, what's the show called? I forgot the name of the show. Santa Clarita Diet. It's a funny show, just to give listeners the pitch if they haven't sort of seen it. I guess you could say, yeah, she's a zombie. They're realtors, basically. And she, basically, yeah, it is Timothy Oliphant who plays the husband. A lot of good chemistry. The girl who plays the daughter is very good. There's a lot of good chemistry in this show. It's a comedy with drama, like dramedy, but more comedy than drama. Like you could almost call it, I guess, satire at times. They're realtors, sort of very upwardly mobile, like, you know, professionals with money. But not too much money, but enough money and, like, one kid and yada, yada, yada. And she gets turned into a zombie somehow, like, where she needs to eat flesh. It's funny. Like, it's a funny movie, a funny show. We're also fans of iZombie, which is, you know, another take on that kind of... It's a kind of a different style of sort of the same thing. Look, it is a lot of fun. It's a funny show, and I'm... But three seasons is maybe about enough. We've watched about half of the second season, and I wouldn't say it's flagging, but, like, it's certainly sort of kind of playing itself out a bit. So, look, I always love Drew Barrymore. I've loved Drew Barrymore, well, I mean, since E.T., but even, like, you know, late 90s, mid-90s, Drew Barrymore, I had a lot of time for her, and she's very good in this, as she always is. Drew, and he's very good, Timothy Oliphant. I knew him from other roles many years ago, but he turns in a good performance here as well. And they've got a lot of good chemistry, the two of them. As I said, the daughter's very funny as well. This is hilarious news. Vin Diesel, like a man who, you know, you wonder, he must be getting huge paychecks from Fast and the Furious because, like, he doesn't do anything else. And he's talking about, like, it was revealed John Cena is going to appear in the next Fast and Furious. If you recall, he had quite the feud with The Rock, Vin Diesel, when The Rock was spinning off. Now, he was talking about John Cena, and I actually rate what he said here because it's so fucking nuts. He tweeted this, I think. "I know this sounds crazy, but every blue moon I feel like Pablo up there sends me someone," Diesel says, "another soldier for the fight for the truth." And the translation was that John Cena, who was pictured, might be in the next Fast and Furious, which was then confirmed. Look, Pablo is, I assume, Paul Morgan, you know, obviously his co-star and friend, who's tragically passed away in a car accident, somewhat ironically. And, yeah, you know, but what a crazy fucking thing to say. Like, John Cena, like, he's a working actor. Like, he's always hunting around for a franchise. Like, this is one of, I would describe this as extremely predictable casting. Like, I don't think this needed a blue moon and Paul Morgan from the afterlife to summon it somehow. But, you know, I just like the crazy shit that Vin Diesel's sort of saying here. And God bless him, I guess. Like, James Gunn loves John Ostrander's run of Suicide Squad. There's an Instagram post confirming this, kids. Like, don't you love it when directors have to feel the need to prove they've read comics? And I know we're supposed to, like, really, really, like buy into it. Like, oh, my God, I'm so excited. Hey, here's a newsflash. I haven't read all of John Ostrander's Suicide Run either. You know, really. Like, I don't care. It's cool. Like, you know, and it's cool he likes it, but, like, there's this desperate need. You know, I'm doing Suicide Squad. I've read all the original run. I read it in shops when it came out. Did you really? I've read one trade that when they put it out. I read a trade. It was pretty good. Yeah, it was good, actually. And I own it all digitally. Am I the world's greatest? You know, like, give me a break. Like, I don't know. James Gunn, not really a shot at James Gunn. Great director. Or at least very good, and certainly hit big with Guardians. And I'm certainly, you know, he's doing. I'm certainly excited to see what he does with Suicide Squad. It's not a sequel. Yes, I understand. Like, you're desperate to reboot the brand, but yet keep the name. Sounds awfully like a reboot or a sequel. No, it's this new thing. Oh, yeah, with some of the same characters. Oh, yeah, but only the really popular ones. Yeah, so anyway, like, that aside, yes, I am excited for it. Everything lines up. Idris Elba being involved, potentially Harley Quinn being involved. A lot of potentialies, I notice. A Polka Dot Man was revealed. I don't mind saying I have no idea who that is. I know who Condiment King is, though, and I assume he's kind of a similar kind of D-E-grade villain of some type. One thing I will say that I do like is I do believe, and this is the good thing about directors doing what I feel is a cheesy act, they're reminding fans out there who might just watch the movies that they're based on real comic books that people drew and wrote and sold and weren't compensated well for at the time. And hopefully people will go and pick those books up and support those creators, you know, who weren't compensated well by the companies at all and still don't see a very big piece of the pie when these movies make big money. Like, that's the part of the story I like, rather than, look at me, I'm really the original fan. Like, I'm the person who was into Nirvana before, like, fucking, you know, Nevermind. Like, you know, that, which is the other angle that story goes. But I do like that he's at least doing that, naming John Ostrander. Is in some ways, that's the part of the movie I appreciate. The desperate need to be validated, I find, you know, somewhat sickening. Like, you're a multimillionaire, worth squillions, bouncing from project to project, you know, just forever trying to appease these fans. Like, there's a part of me that just thinks, really, do you need to do this? Does Francis Ford Coppola do this? Like, does Martin Scorsese do this? Like, I don't know. Anyway, I guess they've got to always, like, just try to connect with the fans, like on Instagram, because it just makes everything so much better. Noah Centineo, a handsome hunk of a lad, I must say. He's playing He-Man for Masters Universe. We did cover this, and I've never heard of him in my life. And, yeah, he's an attractive guy, looks potentially Latino. Anyway, regardless, I thought pretty good casting for He-Man. I wonder what direction they'll go with He-Man, really. I mean, I like He-Man, but my He-Man is like the 80s He-Man cartoon. I don't know. Like, it's a challenge. It's more challenging than you think. You could really embrace it and just make it, like, kind of like a sort of, not a million miles away from a G.I. Joe kind of feel, like, where you really kind of embrace the material. I don't know, like, or you sort of try to modernize it, and I feel that, like, that's what won't work somehow. Like, I don't know, like, it's going to be interesting. You looking at the guy, and you could see he potentially could get super buff, and you could probably sort of do a Conan kind of thing, like, that's how I would prefer him to look. I'm talking visually, like the look, not the characterization. Like, the look, I think you could almost do a sort of Arnie-esque sort of, like, just balls-out barbarian style. But then there's characters like, remembering He-Man from the 80s, like Man-at-Arms. Like, how do you do him? You know, and all the crazy, bizarre fucking monsters and stuff. Like, I almost hope they really lean into it rather than lean away from it. I think that would be more fun. He's apparently got a huge, huge female fan base, and I would assume huge gay fan base as well. And, you know, all these people are going to be huge into making this a hit and could potentially push it. I actually think it's really, really good casting, and I know nothing about this kid, but just visually I thought, yeah, I mean, I think that's, it's kind of a home run casting-wise. And it's watch this space. Now, a Willow TV series is apparently being developed for Disney Plus by Ron Howard with Warwick Davis in the role. I wasn't super hot on Willow, but I know Ron Howard is, and he was talking about it when Solo came out. He kind of quieted down when Solo numbers didn't quite pick up, but the project is still alive. Disney Plus, I say go for it. Like, you know, if there's fans out there, and there's certainly lots of people who like Willow, I was more of a Princess Bride guy, but Willow had its place. I mean, I certainly watched it at the time. I just wonder how popular it is. Like, I get you're appealing to retro, but, you know, how much of that is. Like, I never thought Willow was as good as people sort of remember it being. Like, it's one of those ones, like, Willow. Yeah, I saw it at the time. And I saw it probably then 5 years later, and it was aging pretty badly. Like, pretty badly by the 90s. I don't know how it'd stand up in 2019. But God bless them. They've got to earn a buck somehow. And, okay, John Caston, like, this guy's fucking, like, born into the lap of luxury. Like, he's Larry Kasdan's kid, big Star Wars head, had a huge hand in shaping Solo. And was also attached to Indiana 5. You noticing the fucking connections here? Like, yeah, born into the right fucking family. He's now exiting Indiana Jones 5. It's now being rewritten by This Is Us creator Dan Fogelman, which is a left turn. Another left turn is Harrison ain't getting no younger, kids. So can we just lock a script down and get moving if we want to make this movie? And, like, do we want to make this movie? And I love Harrison Ford. I know Harrison Ford gets more money out of Indiana Jones than he gets out of his Han Solo deal. So Harrison wants to move on it. But, like, you know, meanwhile, Spielberg's, I believe, doing West Side Story. So he's not going to be available for some period. Like, I don't know. Like, it worries me because I feel much like I didn't like King of the Crystal Skull, but I enjoyed it when I was in the cinema. You know what I mean? Like, I dug it because it was the nostalgia, and I really like Harrison Ford. I'll watch Harrison Ford in just about anything. But I do worry that we're tarnishing a legend rather than sort of whatever the opposite is, polishing. I don't know. I don't know what the opposite is. But it just is, it just feels like Indiana Jones, those first three movies, they're just so golden. And but some people don't like Temple of Doom. Well, fuck them. I liked it. I saw it in cinemas with my dad and my sister. I loved it. frankly, it's, you know, it's great. But, like, I don't know. Like, Last Crusade was just so perfect. And Kingdom of Crystal Skull was just not so perfect. It had some funny moments in it. But and Harrison was still good. But, like, I don't know. And, you know, that was a long time ago sort of thing as well. And Harrison's really looking older. Like, I don't know. It just really questioned this movie in a lot of ways. But we'll see, I guess. Like, This Is Us creator is a... That's a left turn. I've never watched an episode of This Is Us. It looked very depressing to me. Like, it looked like the kind of thing where you get a knife out and slash your wrists. Like, maybe I'm reading it wrong, but whenever I saw the ads, they were very heavy on the weepy, which is not what I want in Indiana Jones. So maybe he's been brought in to punch it up dramatically. John Kasdan, you know, yeah, continues with his blessed life, I assume. Why can't I be Larry Kasdan's kids? Why can't I be given the keys to the fucking castle, you know? I'm so bitter. Well, throne talk. Look, you know, I think, in fairness to Stu, I will say this. He is the master of throne talk. He is the throne master, is the title I bestowed upon him. And humble me, you know, hasn't watched season two or three. I've read the first couple of chapters of the first book. Came in late. I have the wall chart on my wall. I haven't spent a lot of time studying, you know, like, a lot's going on. But the last episode, I'll be brief, okay, with my comments. Yes, I enjoyed the battle. Yes, I thought, like everyone else, it was far too dark. Michelle and I thought there was something wrong with our TV. No to the fucking cinematographer. I don't want to be sitting there correcting my fucking TV to watch your stupid fucking episode. Entertain me. Don't make me work so fucking hard. Okay, like, I've come back after a long day at work, eating a meal, I, you know, have my coffee or my tea, I'm tired. Oh, it's going to be an hour and a half. I'm like, oh, Jesus, really? Okay. I mean, my brain, I'm like, oh, okay. Like, this is going to be an hour and a half long battle. I can see it playing out already. Like, it's all so predictable. Okay, but then it comes on. It's dark. They're very disorganized. These people they're fighting, there's lots of them. Like, I enjoyed the episode for what it was. I really, really, and there's spoilers. Hey, guess what? More spoilers, kids. More spoilers. Arya Stark killing the Night King. One of my favorite moments of the series, actually. Really enjoyed it. Apparently there's some controversy online. What a surprise. I mean, I also thought it was the most predictable part of the show, though. Like, where, I don't know her name. The Blood Witch. No, I don't know her name, but the brunette, everyone knows who it is. She brought Jon Snow back to life. When she did the whole, like, locking eyes with Arya Stark, I was like, okay, so Arya Stark's going to be, like, the chosen one. Okay, fine. And, you know, then she was. But I did like the way she killed the Night King. it was kind of cool. It was kind of actually my favorite parts of the episode, and overall enjoyed it. Yes, it was too dark. Yeah, they seemed like really badly organized, and like, I don't know, I just felt like they hadn't put much thought into the battle at all. It felt like they were just like flying by the seat of their pants. Like they really sacrificed their cavalry, really woeful. Like, I'm no military tactician. Like, don't get the impression you're talking to like a war gamer or some guy who's dressing up to reenact the Civil War at Gettysburg or a Napoleonic War or something. Like, no, that's not me. But I know enough to think that I was like, there's a gigantic wave that far outnumbers you and you're just rushing with your cavalry like that and just like, you're just kind of wasting like them. And I don't know. And they didn't really seem to have too many plans going on. There was just a lot of like cannon fodder. It was like everyone was cannon fodder and they had the dragons, but they were badly organized. Was it the Night King who was creating the squalls of wind that basically got them lost? I think it was. But regardless, I've got questions. Tommy Cavill had a question for Stu that, like, I forget the exact wording, but is Arya basically the chosen one is what I believe he was saying. Well, my answer to that, Tommy, is I think yes, man. Like, Stu will weigh in. We'll get his full thoughts next week. Maybe, you know, there's something in the fucking, like, you know, the cameos that is going to reveal his point of view there. But, I mean, I take it as, yeah, that was the oh-so-surprising twist, which would have been a lot more surprising if it wasn't so telegraphed. And if, you know, I didn't think it was perfect TV. I mean, I'd give it a 7 out of 10 for an episode. Like, really, I thought it was like, people were complaining it was too dark. They were right. I was, but it's at night. Like, yeah, guess what? Like, I went and saw 300. They were fighting at night at some point. I could tell what was happening. It's called movie making or TV. Like, Jesus Christ, people shoot at night all the time. It, part of the fucking suspension disbelief is you can tell what's going on. You know, otherwise it's going to get very confusing in a lot of movies very quickly. Yeah, I don't know. It was, I didn't think it was that great. Like, it was entertaining. A lot was going on. But afterwards, I was sort of like, and I saw the people on, you know, Facebook and stuff amping up. And I was like, yeah, I sort of agree with them. Story-wise, I had no real problems. I was really glad Jamie survived and Brynnia Tarth. Multiple times during the episode, I was like, has Jamie died? Only because I like Jamie. I'm not like, he's not like my favorite. But I was like, has he died? Or is that just a really bad, like, you know, sort of like scene that you can't quite tell what's going on? And I feel the excuses the cinematographers give, like, it's a battle, it's meant to be confusing. It's like, yeah, but it was also poorly shot. Like, he was fighting in a corridor that was lit. So it would have been quite possible to tell who that was, but you chose not to do that. So, yeah, I mean, 7 out of 10. Story-wise, I had no complaints. I thought bits of it were really cool. Did Bran know? Like, I don't really understand this. Does he see the future? Like, is he like Dr. Manhattan? Does he know that he's going to succeed how he does? Or did he think he was well and truly fucked by the Night King? Because the Night King, I was kind of like, there was a moment where I was like, I said to Michelle, what's his deal with Bran? Like, why is he so obsessed with Bran anyway? Like, was this explained at some point? And Michelle's like, oh, I think because he can see the past and the future, and if he kills him, he'll be able to do that as well. I'm like, okay, well, all right. We're talking about how is it Targaryen? Is that what you say? Like, you know, he could be burnt. And I was like, yeah, I mean, I read some Twitter thing where I was like, apparently, yeah, he could potentially be the one with the most rightful claim to the throne. We're sort of watching him and I go, apart from, you know, he's a bit crazy. He's a little bit nuts. And she's like, yeah, and the whole undead thing. And I'm like, yeah, that as well. But like, I'm not sure he'd be a sound king. That's the problem with the Night King. Like, yes, he has the power, you know, if he hadn't been killed, like, but would he be sound? Could we trust him with the economy? I have my doubts, you know, and that'd be part of the problem. I guess it's a monarchy. It's not a democracy, so we wouldn't have a vote. It'd be a dictatorship. Would have been sort of interesting alternate world where the Night King, you know, did sit on the Iron Throne, but that's not to be. And now, the politics will play out over episodes 4, 5, and 6, which I believe I was going to say prophesize, but maybe that's too strong a word. Speculated could be a better word. That could potentially be what's going to happen. I think I said that in Last Throne Talk, and Stu, of course, poo-pooed me and said, like, oh, no. Cersei will be no challenge. Well, sorry, she lost a lot of forces, Daenerys, in this battle. Like, I got questions. Are there any of the, how do you say that? Drakathi or whatever? Like, the horse riders. Are there any left? Okay, I like those guys. I'm really quite fond of those guys. Are there any left? Is there one or two dragons left? Did Jon Snow's dragon survive? Like, why do I not have the answers to these questions? Like, that's something that annoys me. I'm one of those people. Quite literal when it comes to my shows. Like, I'd like almost like a battle tally at the end. Can we find out? Why do I have to have it hidden from me? Like, is there one or two dragons? I consider that pretty important, because if there are two dragons, they're going to really fucking dominate Cersei's army. Whereas if there's one, you can see them pulling off some sort of miracle. So it's going to be interesting, because I think George R. R. Martin and the showrunners have really gone down the route of sort of throwing a red herring in the White King in the end. Not easily defeated, but defeated with three shows to spare, meaning the politics will really play out, meaning that Sansa Stark is still alive, meaning that there's going to be conflict between her and the Dragon Queen, not to mention Cersei, who's got like that golden company, whatever the fuck they're called, minus the elephants, which is quite sad for me because, I did speculate Cersei could become undead and then her brother has to kill her. Well, that's clearly not going to happen. Even though I'm only giving that episode a 7 out of 10, I'm very excited for the next episode. I think a lot of interesting stuff's going to play out. I have no real idea what will happen. I had grave fears for Daenerys in that battle, and I have fears for her and for the rest of the show, frankly. I've just got a bad feeling in my gut. I feel like she's being almost led to the guillotine, and we've sort of fallen in love with her, even though she's got some edges, and I just feel that it's headed that way, and that could not be good for her long term. Now, DC Comics, they've got this Year of the Villain. We read an issue in this Weekly Comics. It was revealed that a Secret Six comic is spinning out of that, for the Secret Six fans out there. And it rumored that a new Superman-Batman title is coming out from, I think, Joshua Williamson and David Marquez, who was a Marvel exclusive artist, who's a really good artist, actually. Look, that'd be interesting, I guess, if they do it well. Hopefully they don't do what they have been doing on, like, Justice League and stuff, which has been boring as hell. So Weekly Comics, Deceased One. This was a storyline I very much enjoyed. Tom Taylor, you pretty much always bring the goods. I honestly, like, I don't say this just because he's an Aussie. I genuinely find his storylines so interesting. Good art, a trifle cartoony, but I also noticed this had almost the exact same premise as a Stephen King novel, Cell. Basically people, a disease kind of thing going viral by people looking at their phones and their sort of, mobile devices. Bit of a yawn there. Look, I gave this an 8 out of 10. I really enjoyed this. I think Tom Taylor, all-new Wolverine, a superior Iron Man, he's an Injustice run. This guy's got fucking talent, really got talent, and I consider he's underrated and should be used more. I'd read Tom Taylor over Tom King any day of the week. I took shots at Tom King last week, and I quite like Tom King, but Tom Taylor, I don't know, he plays into my area of interest well. 8 out of 10. I would say if you're a DC fan, go pick this up. It's good. DC's Year of the Villain. Wow. Okay. I'm giving it a 7.5. It's very solid. It's that annoying comic that is just there to set up multiple fucking spin-offs. Now, if you're okay with that, that's what this is. Should be an annual. Should be $2. Seriously. Like, this is the kind of thing that should come out as an annual. It shouldn't be priced whatever outrageous price it's priced at. It should just be, it's an ad, and that's all it is. And I wish they would not do what they do now, where they just overprice these things. You read it, it's an ad setting up multiple other titles, and I think it even says at the end, like, those other titles. Now, that's where publishing has gotten to in terms of comic books. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not really a fan. But that said, it is an interesting storyline. Like Lex Luthor really embracing his inner evil, kind of sacrificing himself to bring about, you know, some sort of, I don't know, like year of the villain, basically. Like he wants to get, he's liquidated all his assets and he's giving all his money and I think tech to all the villains to try to overcome their heroes. Pretty cool. No problems with that. I still find that whole Justice League source wall shit that's been just rolling now for like a fucking year. Some of the most boring stuff the DC have done since like the 70s. It's so dull. It feels like a soap opera. Days of Our Lives in Space is how that Justice League storyline arc feels to me. You come in after not reading for a month and it's just like on the same fucking mission. Oh, well, here's the source wall. Oh, guess who's here? Batman Who Laughs. Oh, what a surprise. Oh my God, I hate it. Like, I hate it because it never ends and it's not interesting. Like, it's just dull. And there's a lot of that at the end of this to tag in the cosmic angle and sign me out. It's the worst part of the comic. The art's very solid, though, and it does. It's very much an ad, and it's a pretty effective ad. So I'm giving it a 7.5. It's pretty solid execution. But I do note my comments about how much I hate that Justice League thing, and just the way it's just running on and on and on, and it's not interesting, and it's the same scenes again and again. DC, lift your game. That aspect is clown town, but the rest of it's pretty good. Now. Savage Avengers 1. This is a comic I've really been waiting for. Okay. I mean, did Jerry Duggan wake up in the middle of the night and go, I've got to make a comic for Dave on Signal. I've got to do it. Hey, who can I have in it? Conan? Check. Wolverine? Check. Punisher? Check. Brother Voodoo? Gets included. And others. But just Frank Castle. Conan. Wolverine. You had me at hello, Jerry. I love this comic. It's great. Great intro. Look, again, it's just an intro episode. Some lovely Conan at the start. Conan's been brought over from that Road Home series. He's in the Savage Land. So he's in the 616 universe, cutting loose in the Savage Land. Just basically doing normal Conan shit in the Savage Land. Bumps in a Wolverine, and there's some really great moments, actually. And it's the best Wolverine I've seen since Jason Aaron was writing Wolverine. Because it's Wolverine, you know, again, properly. And just some good moments. They're small moments. It's got some nice small moments, this comic. And then a really wicked storyline behind it. Like the backbeat of the story of what they're trying to summon here. This is great stuff from Jerry Duggan. I rate Jerry Duggan so highly, so often. He turns up and it's quality. Mike Diodato on art. I mean, this guy never disappoints. This guy is the fucking postman. He delivers. And he does again here. And look, in fairness to Brother Voodoo, he had a pretty cool part of the storyline too. They're trying to sacrifice the best of the best, basically these crazy cultists, to summon some god. I love this kind of shit, like an elder god or something. Like, it's really quite dark and stuff. Like, this is a cool comic. Don't forget Venom's coming. There's kind of a Venom-esque character that's been summoned previously, I believe. I'm not sure if it's explained, but I mean, I hope this comic's like fortnightly. I really am going to read it. Like, and it's not just because it's Conan or Frank Castle and Wolverine. Like, Wolverine's a big part of this too, because I've been starved of my Wolverine. I'm recording this show in my Wolverine t-shirt. Yeah, but I just really enjoyed it. I gave it an 8 out of 10, and you can't give it more than that because it's just an intro episode, you know? But still, I'm down. It succeeded. That wraps up Weekly Comics this week. Yeah, and we'll, you know, we can go into more detail next week of this kind of stuff. Like, Leviathan is the arc that's coming out from DC, this Year of the Villain stuff, and that's the issue that I believe is priced at $10.99 or something, which I think is outrageous. And I don't know, again and again, I say it all day long, like, give the comic fucking publishers more money, Marvel and, you know, Disney and Warner's, like, stop making them, they're just squeezing their audience, like, $10.99 for a one issue, really, that's just, it's too much. For your average consumer, I get the review copies. I wouldn't pay that much for it. Okay, trade of the week.
Old Man Logan, Berserker. So coming out in 2016, following the 2015 massive crossover Secret Wars event, Marvel had an opportunity to bring back Old Man Logan as told in this Elseworlds kind of tale by Mark Miller and Steve McNiven. And when they decided to bring these guys back in, they had the kind of wasteland as part of Secret Wars. And following, they brought Old Man Logan just flashing straight back in. And what we've read this week is kind of an introduction to this character, or reintroduction to this character. But more accurately, it's an introduction to this world for this character. So we see Old Man Logan kind of wake up in this new, all-new Marvel universe for the first time. And the first thing he wants to do is fix what went wrong in his version. He realizes that he's traveled to the past, although what he doesn't realize is this isn't his past. Travels to the past, he tries to fix the mistakes. He writes himself a little hit list, taking down the people that ruined his life and then the people that set in motion the events that changed his world. So the Black Butcher is the first name on his list, and he writes it himself, an absolute D-lister. Logan comes in and absolutely destroys him early on, and you get the sense this is going to be a violent telling, a violent tale. It's a great start for this character. It's a really cool start. The artwork by Andrea Sorrentino is amazing here. The use of the black-bordered panels and the white-bordered panels to show current and past events, I think, is a clever way to do it. It's a nice, subtle way to show you when you're going into the past and when you're viewing Logan as he is now. So it makes the storytelling effortless. You can fly through it quite easy. The panel layout itself is beautifully done as well. But Jeff Lemire's writing is just top-notch here. He's putting together a very complicated, complex character who's come through more trauma than anybody else ever has, and is coming to terms with it in his own way, and it's brilliantly done. There's a reason that Old Man Logan is one of my all-time favourite comics. And this, while I don't feel it quite lives up to Old Man Logan, the original run, I do feel like this is a great place to start off with this character. We know how it ends up. We know that Marvel haven't treated Wolverine, in our view, correctly. You know, we've had issues with how they've reintroduced Wolverine and how Old Man Logan's been treated. But I feel if you're looking at this book and this book alone, the introduction to the character is actually pretty good. It's a brilliant way to bring him in. I'm not too fussed on the whole White Flash and he's there. I kind of wish he'd had some recollection of Battleworld, of what happened in Secret Wars. I think that would have been a cool introduction. But, you know, it is what it is. We get this character in there. It's a brutal start. He then ends up fighting Amadeus Cho's Hulk. This is kind of the version of Amadeus Cho I don't hate. He's completely hulked out the whole time. Wolverine's stabbing him, cutting him. And it's pretty quick. It's fast-paced. It's quick-moving. You don't get bored. You don't get enough time to really delve into the Amadeus Cho's background. But he's used fine. He's used fine as a non-banner Hulk, which confuses, disorients him. I like that it's Old Man Captain America that is the person to convince him that he's not in his past. By showing him the adamantium-clad statue of Wolverine, the body of Wolverine. We then get kind of an odd story following up the kind of hit list when he realizes he's in a different world and he wants to do his own thing. You get an odd kind of story where he goes back to find the people he cared about, his future wife, from the Wasteland story, but as a kid, so he can kind of protect her and look after her, which I suppose makes some kind of sense, but it's still an odd through line, seeing as this girl who he's going to marry is at the current, you know, present state, like, you know, 10 years old, maybe 8 years old or something. And he kind of grows up in this, spends time in this small town looking after her, which of course brings the Reavers, brings danger towards the town. People get shot and killed. He ends up taking down a few of them in some pretty cool scenes. Very cool. The action scenes are brilliantly done in this book. I really enjoy the action scenes. For me, there's a lot of great, great elements. I think Jeff Lemire's writing is really good. It's not quite Mark Miller's standard, but right up there. Andrea Sorrentino's artwork is phenomenally good. I think it suits Logan and this kind of slightly darker, older, more weathered feel really well. It's just phenomenal artwork. This is a good read. It is a good read, and I really do recommend it if you've read and enjoyed Old Man Logan. If you love Wolverine, I think this is a solid Wolverine story. I think it's a really great place to start. It doesn't quite reach the heights of its predecessor. But in the new universe, post-Secret Wars, this has probably been the best Wolverine we've had for the last 4 or 5 years, this story. I've quite enjoyed it. My final score, I don't know what Dave's doing, but my final score is going to be a 7 out of 10. I think it's very readable, very enjoyable, and it's a nice quick read. I can pick it up and put it down in a day. I think it's very much worthwhile picking up. So, 7 out of 10. Back to you, Dave.
Old Man Logan, Berserker. Now, just to clue everyone in, okay, we've done the original Old Man Logan early in the show, and it was Mark Miller, and who is the artist? Steve McNiven was on art, I believe, and it was fantastic. And it's an acclaimed series. They brought Old Man Logan's storyline back during the Secret Wars Battle World stuff. I want to say I think Bendis wrote it, but then anyway, they brought Old Man Logan into the 616 universe at the conclusion of Secret Wars, basically. And this is the first arc in his run. I'd not read it. Jeff Lemire on art duties and some really, really nice artwork, actually. And in fact, this is quite an art. This is not what I was expecting, actually. This is more of an art book than it is a story. The story is quite thin, but it does have some good moments. I want to bring up the artist because even though I don't know his name, I think it's actually quite a popular artist. Look. What can I say about this book? Like, it really is grumpy. Okay, Andrea Sorrentino. Now, it really is nice artwork. It's reminds me a bit of a Jai Lee art. I'm no art expert, but it's a similar sort of style. And look, the pitch is pretty simple. Old Man Logan wakes up from a white light, which was the end of Secret Wars. And he's in the 616 universe. And so he's Logan, but he's Logan after the events of Old Man Logan. So he's a lot older, diminished healing facility. I think still has his claws, although he doesn't use them. There's a lot of flashbacks to his past and sort of cues into the Old Man Logan storyline. He's grumpier than regular Wolverine. He's wearier, basically. And that's the aspect that I guess is interesting, like variation on the Wolverine prototype, but it's probably where it's not my Wolverine kind of comes in. But it is interesting. It's a well-told story. The art's very good. It has some nice nods to Marvel at the time. For example, he goes to Hawkeye, who is his buddy in Old Man Logan, and Kate Bishop's Hawkeye. He goes to kill Hulk because the Hulk in his timeline, I think, killed and raped his wife and kids. Maybe not raped them, but definitely killed them. And it was just an all-around crazy guy. Like, Banner in that universe was just evil, personified. Whereas it's Amadeus Cho, who I can't stand, but it works quite well here because everything is not how he thought he'd just come from the... He thought he'd come from the future and tried to repair the past by killing all the people that basically screwed with him you know, to create the dystopian nightmare that became the world and his life, in Old Man Logan. So he tries to reverse that and then realizes gradually that he's actually in an alternate timeline, basically. Like, okay, which is, cool. But as I said, it's a slight story. You glide across it. I read it really in one sitting. It's good. It's not great. It's good. It's like, it's 6.5 out of 10. Like, it's not the best Wolverine I've ever read. The art is probably more like an 8.5 out of 10. And it, to be fair to the story, it really flows with the artwork. So it is a nice marriage of story and art, but it is quite a slight story. And nothing's really that interesting. And, like, Old Man Logan, you're sort of like, do we really need this? Like, I guess at the Marvel Summit, it seemed like a cool idea. And, yeah, it does sound cool, but then you get him and you're like, okay, well, it's really just Wolverine old and grumpier and not as powerful and more of a sad sack. And that's where you kind of lose me. Like, he's kind of a bit of a, well, I mean, shit went badly for him, so, justified whining, I guess, but, like, it's still just whining. And, I don't know, like, Berserker? I didn't see too much Berserker. I saw a lot of, like, fucking bitching and, like, whining and, like, was going to beat someone up but didn't, Berserker? I didn't see him fly into a Berserker rage at any point. Maybe I missed it. I wish I'd seen it. Some of the better moments are the flashbacks. As I said, overall, it's at least a 7, and the art's very good. It's an 8.5 art. Not the kind of art I want to see in every comic book, but it's beautiful, and, she does a fantastic job. Andrea Sorrentino, really, really, really great job. Jeff Lemire, I usually find him quite overrated, and here again, I don't really quite see the fucking hype. It feels like a very slight story. This could have been a one and done, but this could have been 30 pages and done. I don't know why we had to endure issues of it. I certainly didn't read it finishing. Like, I always think this with these kind of stories. Do I want to desperately read the next issue? No. I had my fill of Old Man Logan. I don't know why Marvel killed Wolverine if all they were going to do is bring an Old Man Logan and try to put him on teams and then wonder why this aged. Here's an example. Paul McCartney, okay, in the Beatles versus Paul McCartney now. You know what I mean? Like, in terms of seeing, and all that kind of stuff. Like, yeah, great, nothing against the guy. Great guy, fantastic guy. But, like, as an artist, like, you're going to take the 60s version. Like, you don't want the kind of now version. Same with Wolverine. Why do I want Wolverine kind of like sort of all bitched out and just all crumpled up and all broken and defeated and what's the point? And not even in a hard-ass way. It's just kind of like, well, what's the point? And, like, he does a little tour of the Marvel Universe, and I can't imagine someone reading this and going, man, this is great Wolverine. Like, it's like, this is pretty watered down, like, lame Wolverine. I'm only going to give it a 7 out of 10, and it's the art that's making it. The story's quite slight, frankly. And at the end, it's like, oh, I wonder what happens next. And it's like, I don't care. Like, I know what happens next. You try to put him into regular teams. Wolverine, like, older in a fucking trench coat. Like, it sucked. You didn't know what to do with him. You had basically the bare bones of a characterization, and you never go beyond it. Like, that's what happened. And all that happened is Wolverine fans like me were just like, where the fuck is normal Wolverine? Like, Tom Taylor did a fantastic job with X-23, a character that I prefer about a billion times more than Old Man Logan. She's nowhere to be seen in this issue. The stuff with Kate Bishop's great. Like, Kate Bishop's cool. It felt like Jeff Lemire was having more fun with the guest characters than he was with the main guy. Old Man Logan, frankly, is a bit of a bore. So, I don't know, guys. Like, I wouldn't be rushing down to my local fucking store to purchase Old Man Logan. Like, what I do wish is like, we're finally seeing Wolverine filter through into teens, but as I keep saying, where's Wolverine the main title? Like, why can't we have, like, Greg Rucka on Wolverine? One of the greatest Wolverine runs I'd seen outside of, like, Larry Hammer. Like, yeah, like, put someone who's not Jeff Lemire or fucking Chucky Soule
on Wolverine and watch it sing. Remind me again how cool Wolverine is. Jerry Duggan reminded me in Savage Avengers 1. That's the Wolverine I want to see. You know, he was about a bazillion times more badass than Old Man Logan. Old Man Logan, you know, if we weren't living in, like, corporate fucking, like, dystopian, like, you know, Disney world, there's no way Old Man Logan would be an ongoing series because there's just simply not enough storyline to tell. They couldn't even keep him in his own timeline. They had to bring him into the 616 for some reason, like, so they could do Clash of Styles. Like, oh, imagine if Old Man Logan bumped into, like, Hawkeye, but it wasn't Hawkeye. Oh, wow, imagine. And then, you know, like, there are some interesting scenes. Imagine if he bumps into the Hulk and it's not Banner. Oh, my God. Like, really, it's quite cheesy. Like, Jeff Lemire, what a genius. No, not really. Like, pretty predictable, pretty cheesy. 6 out of 10 for story, because, you know, he does marry it to the art well. But 7 out of 10 overall, carried by the art. I won't say too much more on it. I want to read this out. Like, when I was reading a lot of, listening to a lot of Bob Dylan earlier this week, and I came across this quote from Hunter S. Thompson. He was talking about the 60s. It's from Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. And he's talking about driving around, basically, you know, and getting fucking loaded back in the day down in San Francisco. There was madness in any direction at any hour. If you ran across the bay, then up the Golden Gate or down 101 to Los Altos or La Honda, you could strike sparks anywhere. There was this fantastic universal sense that whatever we were doing was right, that we were winning. And that, I think, was the handle, that sense of an inevitable victory over the forces of old and evil. Not in any mean or military sense, we didn't need that. Our energy would simply prevail. There was no point in fighting on our side or theirs. We had all the momentum. We were riding the crest of a high and beautiful wave. So now, less than 5 years later, you can go up to a steep hill in Las Vegas and look west. And with the right kind of eyes, you can almost see the high watermark, that place where the wave finally broke and rolled back. And that's kind of what I was feeling like as I was listening to some of that early Bob Dylan and stuff like that. And like you listen to like Simon & Garfunkel, you know, there's some live albums from the 60s and like the mid-60s. And the sense of optimism and naivety that was in the air, but it would have been so infectious. And, you know, we packaged that. We corporatized that. And I've been watching Woodstock, the original, on film. And, like, that scene out of Omega Man where he's like, watching it. And then I go and watch the original film. I love the original movie. And yet they're so fucking out of it, these hippies. They really are. Like, they're begging for a beating in a lot of ways. And yet, you just think only a couple of years before, like, well, how magical it must have seemed. Like, it's all such a beautiful lie. It's interesting. And then you look at this prick who tried to create Woodstock again in, like, 99. And, like, there's fires being created in the crowds. Like, people getting raped in the mosh pit. And then we look now, and he's still trying to do it. Like, I was going berserk on Facebook about it. But, like, it's so funny. Like, and you look back and, like, the idealism of those times, being in them would have been quite magical, and yet, you know, here we are. So anyway, like, this was a long episode of me kind of monologuing. I hope I entertained, you know. I hope Stu's cameos pop in. I mean, I miss the main man. You need him, guys, because me week after week, you know, wow, I've got a lot of albums in me, but it's gonna get dark. It's gonna get real bleak. It's going to get more than bleak. It's just going to get dark. You're going to have a light of candle and to keep going sort of thing. And, you know, just killing. That's what I'll get down to. So we need Stu. We need the main man. We need him out of that you know, hyper chamber, out of that back to tank, and get him back. I almost picture Stu on a wheelchair at the moment, Professor X style. Maybe he's got a mask on or something, you know. And, you know, we need that pop. So hopefully he's back next week. I hope you've enjoyed this. A shorter episode, to be sure, but a lot of Dave, you know. Peace out there. Look, I want to say this as well. Deep from the bottom of my heart and from Stu's heart, our last episode, the one we did on Avengers Forever, was our most popular episode that we've done yet. We've had a lot of new listeners that have come in recent months. And I really appreciate it, and I really appreciate our old listeners and just our regular listeners, everyone. I appreciate everybody, but I just really get a charge out of it.
Follow us on the Facebook page, Signal of Doom on Facebook. There's Signal of Doom Twitter, and my Twitter handle's at RedLantern2051. Check out some of the other podcasts in the collective. I've said it so many times this episode, Inner Demons, Into the Night. Like, these are fucking must-haves. If you like Moon Knight, you should be listening to Into the Night. If you like Ghost Rider, you need to be listening to Inner Demons. It's got to be fucking... You get up out of bed, you know what I'm saying? Like, have a coffee, put Signal on, blast it. Inner Demons, blast it. Into the Night, blast it. You're just blasting it, like, all day long. And, you know, I think that'd be pretty cool. Other than that, there are other collective members. I'm not your target demographic. I just love the fucking title. I love it. I'm not your target demographic. Or is it I am your target demographic? Either one is cool. Adam's a great guy. There's a lot of them. Bobby Moriarty, shout out. We love our collective members. I'm not even sure. It's a mystery what we're doing next week because Stu and I haven't discussed it. I think it's my choice. God. And as usual, I've got absolutely no idea. On the Facebook page, I'll announce what we're doing next week. Celebrate Free Comic Book Day. Get down to your local store. Pick up a free comic. Pick up a book on the shelf. You know, support them. They're you know, brick and mortar businesses. They need our support. Other than that, keep it fucking safe on the streets, I guess. You know, keep punching. Keep killing if you have to. If the shit's going to go down, fucking stay active. Stay mobile. All right. Peace out, kids. Good night.